And from the KTOO newsroom in Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumery. Thank you for tuning in. Rumors have been circulating on social media that U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, or ICE, have detained tribal citizens in Juneau. But local officials say that is not true. City and Borough Mayor Beth Weldon says some of the speculation is due to a miscommunication.
We, as a collective, including the chief of police and the city attorney, we have not heard of anybody being detained or even questioned about their immigration status, for that matter. Not to say that won't change, but that's what we know right now.
She says the city doesn't have information about ICE agents in town or anyone being detained by them. Juneau Police Deputy Chief Craig Campbell said in an email that the department has received calls asking about ICE presence in Juneau, but they haven't received any reports of Juneau residents being detained. He said federal agencies not stationed in Juneau will usually notify the department when they are in Juneau. And he asked residents to inform JPD if they encounter ICE officers in town. Campbell says that U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents are in town for drug enforcement support. That agency is separate from ICE, though both are under the Department of Homeland Security. These agents could have been mistaken for ICE officers. The Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska President Chahi Ish Richard Peterson issued a statement saying that there is no substantiated evidence that tribal citizens have been detained in Juneau. Nevertheless, Peterson encouraged tribal members to make sure their tribal IDs have not expired and to carry them when out in public. Governor Mike Dunleavy touted his administration's accomplishments and outlined plans for his final 2 years in office during his 7th annual State of the State address yesterday. Dunleavy called it the fourth quarter of his administration.
I'm optimistic about this final quarter, and that's because I can look back at the past 6 years and see what we've accomplished by working together as a team of Alaskans to fulfill the destiny embedded in our state motto, quote, north to the future.
Dunleavy argued that the state had made significant progress on a number of key issues, from jobs to public safety to oil and gas development on the North Slope. The governor also offered clues about his approach to working with the legislature this year on some of House and Senate leaders' key priorities. Both bipartisan majority caucuses are working on bills that would significantly boost education funding. But Dunleavy says those funding boosts should be paired with reforms.
I'll talk to anyone about money if the conversation is also about different approaches and better outcomes.
Dunleavy also touted his approach to the state budget, saying his administration has held government spending in check. State Senator Bill Wulikowski, an Anchorage Democrat, says that doesn't square with the $1.5 billion deficit Dunleavy proposed ahead of this session. He says he's glad to see progress on oil and gas and other resource projects, but he says the benefits aren't widely felt across the state.
It's a tale of two economies. You have one group of people doing very well, the wealthy, the powerful, the privileged, the connected, the huge corporations doing great. But the average Alaskan, I think if you ask them on the street how you're doing, they're struggling to get by.
Even so, Senate leaders said they were glad to hear Dunleavy call for lawmakers to work together on bipartisan issues. And starting this summer, the Greater Sitka Chamber of Commerce will no longer provide visitor services for the city. Under its current contract, the city pays the chamber just under $600,000 a year to oversee the city's visitor services program, Visit Sitka. The contract expires on June 30th, and the chamber has announced it will not pursue a new contract. In a press release last week, Board President Holly Meyer said the organization decided against bidding for a new contract due to, quote, structural differences that were not aligned with the chamber's management of Visit Sitka. The decision to pull out comes after the Sitka Assembly reevaluated its visitor services contract last year and decided to issue an updated Request for Proposals, or RFP. Assembly members pushed for changes to the contract to reflect the city's changing needs as the tourism industry grows. According to the chamber's announcement, the scope of the work the city will require in the new contract includes, quote, deliverables that are outside of the chamber's core focus and mission. In the chamber statement, Meyer writes that not pursuing a new contract with the city will, quote, allow the chamber to focus on high-priority business initiatives, workforce development, workforce housing, and child care. And the Alaska Board of Fisheries kicked off their highly anticipated regulatory meeting in Ketchikan yesterday. The 7-person state board is set to deliberate on nearly 160 proposals over the next 2 weeks. And their votes will determine how the Alaska Department of Fish and Game manages fisheries in Southeast Alaska. KRBD's Jack Darrell is courtside and brings us this rundown of the week one proposals before the board.
The Alaska Board of Fisheries meets every 3 years to consider changes to Southeast Alaska fisheries. This meeting is divided into two sessions to cover the 160 proposals. And they run the gamut from relatively small tweaks, like how longline fishermen have to fill out their logbooks, to bigger shifts, like allowing residents to take home yellow-eye rockfish again. That fishery has been shuttered for years. And there are also proposals before the board to change when and how sport and commercial fishermen can catch black cod in southeast waters. Then we have shellfish. 51 proposals affecting dive fisheries like gooey duck clams and sea cucumbers, changing the season for shrimping, and interestingly, making an entirely new jig fishery for deepwater magister squid. That proposal came from Richard Yamada, a Juneau-based businessman head of the International Pacific Halibut Commission. Yamada says in the proposal that the fishery could provide another revenue stream for struggling commercial fishermen and tamp down magister squid predation on more economically viable catches like salmon and herring. His proposal was backed by Juneau's Fish and Game Advisory Committee. Then there are the raft of proposed Dungeness crab policy changes. Some proposals seek to open up whole areas that have been closed to commercial crabbing for dungies in recent years. Like Petersburg fisherman Derek Tinas's proposal alleges that sea otters' enclosures have made the commercial harvest area for the crabs so small that the commercial fishery is close to no longer being economically viable. But then other proposals call for further closures, blaming overfishing. After presentations from biologists, the board will hear public testimony and indigenous traditional knowledge reports. Then it's back to the board to deliberate. The board expects to start voting on some decisions over the weekend before turning their attention to salmon and herring and finfish next week. The meeting runs through February 9th at the Ted Ferry Civic Center in Ketchikan. At the Board of Fish in Ketchikan, I'm Jack Darrell.
And protections for 28 million acres of wilderness lands across the state have once again been called into question by the sweeping executive order for the state of Alaska released by the White House last week. As KYUK's Evan Erickson reports, tribal stakeholders of the lands remain opposed to the move and are preparing for the next fight.
In August 2024, tribal and conservation groups in Alaska celebrated the U.S. Interior Department's move to finalize federal protections for 28 million acres of wilderness lands across the state. Now, the Trump administration has directed the agency through executive order to remove those protections as part of an effort to maximize resource development in Alaska. More than half of Alaska's 229 federally recognized tribes have come out in strong opposition to opening the lands known as D1 lands to potential development. They say it could further threaten food security at a time when subsistence resources are already in peril, including near-total salmon fishing closures on the Yukon River. Eugene Paul, former first chief of the Lower Yukon River community of Holy Cross, chairs the Bering Sea Interior Tribal Commission, a group representing 38 of the tribes in opposition. He says he hopes that dialogue will be possible with the new Secretary of Interior, Doug Burgum of North Dakota.
I know we're going to be uphill battle again, but we're ready. I mean, I think we're going to be prepared to, you know, educate who's going to be in his cabinet. Maybe we could sit down with him.
The 28 million acres in question are scattered across Alaska, but the majority lie in the vast western reaches of the state, where they overlap with the range of the declining western Arctic caribou herd and trace large portions of the Yukon and Kuskokwim river systems. The question of D1 land status goes back more than five decades, when they were set aside in the public interest by the Interior Department following passage of the 1971 Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Numerous initiatives, some successful, have been made to show that opening the lands to potential development through what are known as public land orders is in the public interest rather than leaving them closed. The recent White House directive turns back the clock to what was attempted in 2021 during the final days of the first Trump administration under then-Interior Secretary David Bernhardt. The Biden administration quickly reversed Bernhardt's public land orders, citing legal defects and a lack of consultation with tribes, and initiating a years-long review of the potential impacts of removing protections. Charisse Arce, a senior attorney with the nonprofit environmental law firm Earth Justice, says it isn't clear what strategy the Trump administration may use given the extensive documentation backing the current D1 protections.
They're going to have to address these facts, which I think will be difficult because, you know, there was 19 different public meetings and a pretty robust public process and extensive evidence gathering. As the executive order is written, it's just simply to reinstate them in their original form, but they'll still suffer from the same legal defects.
Alaska Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan have previously co-sponsored legislation aimed at opening up the D1 lands, and Murkowski has called the BLM's analysis that led to the protections currently in place unilateral and unnecessary. Alaska Governor Mike Dunleavy has also been a strong proponent of opening D1 lands. In a press conference last week praising Trump's executive order, Dunleavy didn't specifically address the D1 lands, but spoke generally about the benefits of resource development for rural Alaskans.
In the rural parts of the state of Alaska, where some of our most economically disadvantaged fellow Alaskans live, they want opportunity. They want the ability for their kids to stay close to home.
But for Paul of Holy Cross, the concept of jobs holds a different meaning in communities where he says roughly 75% of food comes from subsistence. He's also skeptical that opening up D1 lands to potential development would lead to local job creation.
We don't have the economy of, you know, having jobs and stuff. I mean, if they say that they're going to have more jobs if they open up lands, I don't see it happening because it never did work in the past. People fly in, they fly their own people in, and they get their job done and they fly out. And that's it.
With the sprawling list of actions in Trump's Alaska-specific executive order, Interior Secretary Burgum has much more than just the issue of D1 lands on his plate. It remains to be seen whether tribal or conservation groups will ultimately decide to mount a legal challenge. The Department of Interior did not immediately respond to a request for comment. In Bethel, I'm Evan Erickson.
And as for the weather here in Juneau, it's currently 31 degrees and cloudy, but more snow is on the way tonight. In fact, there's a winter weather advisory in effect from 6 p.m. tonight until 3 p.m. tomorrow. We may get between 3 to 8 inches of snow in that time period. Temperatures look like they'll be in the mid-20s. Then on Thursday night, it looks like the snow will stop and it'll get a bit colder and clear. You're listening to KTOO.